From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It will not be an Iraq War II, the president said last night. It will be American airstrikes. It will be regional partners, boots on the ground. But it is America headed back into the fray.
America will lead a broad coalition to roll back this terrorist threat. Our objective is clear. We will degrade and ultimately destroy ISIL.
ISIL, ISIS, the Islamic State, the latest face of a region's turmoil. President Obama says it will take years to take down, and crossed borders. This hour on point, President Obama's new battle plan in Iraq and beyond. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you on board? What do you see coming? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we will hear from two members of Congress on the president's plans. But joining me first today from Washington is Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for The New York Times, author of the book The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and a War at the Ends of the Earth. Mark Mazzetti, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be back.
Listen with us, if you would, once more to this graph from the president's speech last night, Mark, saying it's time to eradicate a cancer like ISIL, the president said, but that this mission will be different from Iraq and Afghanistan.
I want the American people to understand how this effort will be different from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It will not involve American combat troops fighting on foreign soil. This counterterrorism campaign will be waged through a steady, relentless effort to take out ISIL wherever they exist using our air power and our support for partners' forces on the ground.
Mark Mazzetti with The New York Times. You've watched this unfold over time now. I mean, we've all seen the video that came out. We've seen a president for years reluctant to get back in, who was eager to get out. Does this formula, if this is the strategy, and there's a lot of conversation around the edges of this, but if this is the strategy, American air power from on high and regional partners' boots on the ground, how's that being received? Does it look like a workable strategy to people thinking about this challenge, Mark?
Well, there weren't a whole lot of details, specifics put forth last night by the president, but it's really the model that Obama has embraced as a president. He talked about Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. I mean, this is the model of warfare that he, as president, has advanced wherever he could to fight terrorism with drone strikes, with local partners using local militias. He also has used special operations forces, although in this case, he says he's not going to have American combat forces returning to Iraq or Syria. But it's not surprising to hear Obama talk about this is what he wants to do. What is surprising, as you laid out, was that he is getting the United States back into Iraq and possibly Syria when he has been so reluctant to do so for years. This has been a years-long story to watch the president try to hold back while others have said the United States should directly get involved specifically with Syria.
Simple questions. If it's not American boots on the ground, not American combat boots, so he's sending more Americans, 475, bring the total to 1,600 or so in Iraq. Whose boots? Whose boots will do the groundwork while America attacks from the sky?
Two different stories in two different countries. If you look at Iraq, you're talking about an Iraqi army and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters in the north who would take on ISIS with the benefit of having American air power. This is kind of what we've already been seeing going on over the last couple of months since the strikes started, since ISIS took Mosul and advanced into northern Iraq. We all know that the Iraqi army is, especially in the north, is a ramshackle, defeated group of forces. So they need to be once again rebuilt. So that's Iraq. Syria is an entirely different and a much more complicated story, because who's going to be fighting on the ground there? The solution that President Obama talked about last night and other members of his administration have talked about is the Syrian rebels, a group of people that have been armed and trained on a very, very limited scale by the Obama administration. But now the president's talking about expanding that training, putting these fighters, making them his ground army to take on ISIS. But this is another thing that could take some time, and something that the president himself only recently said, you know, this could never work. In an interview with my colleague Tom Friedman a few weeks ago, he said it was fantasy to say that, you know, you could turn this group of, you know, pharmacists and doctors in Syria into a fighting force that could take on either President Assad or ISIS.
Is there any other regional partner that might provide boots on the ground there? Turks? Saudis?
Well, it's there's certainly regional partners who are joining the fight. Turks, Saudis, Emiratis, Jordanians. There's no shortage of people who want to line up to fight ISIS. But as you raise the point, who's going to actually do the fighting? That's unclear. Who would actually provide forces, maybe possibly special forces, some of their own special forces to fight on the ground in Syria? It's certainly possible, and it certainly seems more plausible that they would be doing it than having American combat forces, at least when we're talking about Syria.
But there was no announcement of that last night. And as you say, the non-jihadi, more moderate Syrian opposition, long, almost derisively dismissed by analysts in Washington, including the president of the United States. Here's the president again last night saying, we'll send some more American service members to Iraq, but it's really not boots on the ground that are the American contribution here, he said.
We will send an additional 475 service members to Iraq. As I've said before, these American forces will not have a combat mission. We will not get dragged into another ground war in Iraq. But they are needed to support Iraqi and Kurdish forces with training, intelligence, and equipment.
And will American military forces hit targets in Syria? Yes, the president clearly said last night.
I've made it clear that we will hunt down terrorists who threaten our country wherever they are. That means I will not hesitate to take action against ISIL in Syria as well as Iraq. This is a core principle of my presidency. If you threaten America, you will find no safe haven.
Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for the New York Times, is with us. Mark, what does it mean to cross that border, to take the fight into Syria?
Again, there weren't a whole lot of details presented last night, but the people I talked to seem to think that if the president is going to do anything in Syria, at least initially, it is going to be something that is focused around specific individuals who might be leadership targets of ISIS. So, you know, along the lines of what he's done in Pakistan and Yemen is try to get intelligence about leadership of these terrorist groups and then kill them. The president has not shown a hesitancy if he has intelligence about specific individuals to go kill them. And so if Baghdadi, who's the leader of ISIS, was ever popped up in American intelligence and he was in Syria, you could certainly see the Obama administration, President Obama himself, authorizing a strike against Baghdadi. Now, it doesn't right now, I don't think, mean this sort of blanket airstrikes to hit possible ISIS positions in Syria or camps in Syria. I could be wrong, but I don't think that that's what the president sees as a very valuable course of action, at least at the moment. And I don't see strikes on the other side of the border, meaning Syria, to necessarily take place immediately because the intelligence is still pretty poor about where ISIS is in Syria and where, more importantly, the leadership is.
Do the security analysts that you talk to see Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia as credible models for the challenge here? I mean, after all, in just a few weeks that we've been making airstrikes on the Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL, whatever you want to call it, we've outstripped by far what we've ever done in Yemen and Somalia in terms of the numbers, and I think even more than Pakistan at the height of drone attacks there. Are those really models for this challenge?
I think it depends on what your goal is. You know, what is your definition of success? You know, some people were saying last night, you know, how can we call Yemen and Somalia success stories, right? It's hardly the
– or even
the
model, models.
Or even models. Well, if the model is you get intelligence to find specific people and kill them, you know, that is a model that the president could use, again, specifically in Syria. I think
– but were they taking turf like the Islamic State? Did they have that kind of head of steam?
No. I mean they had different ambitions. So so a group like al-Qaeda in Pakistan was basically hiding. And now in Yemen, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was was taking some territory, but they didn't have the same ambitions that this group does. It's a different group. The people I talk to say this is far more of a sort of a counter of an insurgent force than it is a pure terrorist force. Their goal, as they've said, is to have a caliphate and to run it. It's not just to be in hiding and send people necessarily into the West to carry out attacks. So your point is a good one about whether this model is anything we've seen before. I think the White House is still wrestling with what kind of model will it be. I think the easy answer for them is if in Syria, as I said, they get intelligence, they can take airstrikes and they can kill people. But what will that do to ISIS as an organization? That's still unclear because this is not this doesn't operate the same way as Al Qaeda or even the Al Qaeda affiliates do.
Coalition, I don't know. Here's the latest report from the Associated Press. Britain says it will not take part in airstrikes on Syria. And strategy, what's the end game here? Degrade and ultimately destroy. Is it clear what that means, Mark?
No, and these are terms that that presidents use, and but they don't translate necessarily into a battle plan. President Obama, I think, felt like he had to have the right language last night to sound forceful. But now the answer is, how do you go about doing that? And destroying a terrorist organization is a years-long process if it ever happens.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama's battle plan for taking on ISIS, the Islamic State, what it counts on, where it may lead. Big speech last night, a speech surely he never thought he would give. Surely he never wanted to give. The president who called the Iraq War dumb, who wanted to get out of Iraq, put a lot of energy into that campaign for re-election on having accomplished that, having that on the way. Now, no boots on the ground, he says, no redux of Iraq and Afghanistan wars, but American forces definitely back in, American commitment definitely on the line again here. We're going to hear from a couple of congressmen in this section of our conversation. A little more from the president here first. Last night, here's the president talking about the threat of ISIL, as he calls it, to the region and potentially to the United States.
ISIL poses a threat to the people of Iraq and Syria and the broader Middle East, including American citizens, personnel, and facilities. If left unchecked, these terrorists could pose a growing threat beyond that region, including to the United States.
And does he have the authority to head right in there with American forces if only from the sky or mainly from the sky? Wasn't so easy on Syria a year ago. Last night he said he would welcome congressional support, but he's got the authority.
I have the authority to address the threat from ISIL. But I believe we are strongest as a nation when the President and Congress work together. So I welcome congressional support for this effort in order to show the world that Americans are united in confronting this danger.
Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for the New York Times, joins us today. With us right now from Washington, Congressman Brad Sherman, Democratic representative from California's San Fernando Valley. Senior Democratic member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, serves on the Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on International Terrorism, Nonproliferation, and Trade. Congressman Sherman, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Does the president have the authority to do what he outlined last night without a vote from the U.S. Congress?
For 60 or 90 days, yes. Thereafter, no. And obviously, his plan is not a 60-day plan. There's kind of almost a silent conspiracy in Washington. You've got presidents who always want power and don't want Congress to actually be necessary to do anything. And you've got Congress, which often wants to shirk responsibility and avoid taking tough votes. So I think we've got to defend the U.S. Constitution. The War Powers Act is on the statute books and ought to be followed and is constitutional. But my fear is that Congress won't act and won't demand that the president respect the law.
We're going to hear from a Republican congressman in just a moment, but let's get your view on the merits of this plan. If it were put to a vote, as outlined last night, would you vote up or down, and why?
I would vote up if it was as outlined. What often happens is presidents come. They lay out a plan, a moderate-sized plan, but then they ask for a blank check. So they present a resolution that says the president gets to do whatever he wants anywhere in the Middle East forever. And I think a resolution that reflected the president's plan would be one that I would vote for.
There are supporters. There are plenty of critics here. David Rothkopf at Foreign Policy magazine writing, the strategy requires achievable goals and a plan to realize them. The speech lacked key components in both respects. I mean, is this a full strategy, and does it look like an effective strategy to you, Congressman Sherman? And if so, how? Why?
Well, what the American people want is a plan that guarantees the immediate and total destruction of ISIS with no significant American casualties. The fact is, that doesn't exist. And you can't. The president's approach is one that will degrade, contain, and punish ISIS, and that's all you can do in the short term. Now, one hopes that over years we can achieve something. Nobody, any plan that was more detailed than the president laid out would no doubt have to be changed as soon as the war efforts began. You can't. When we entered World War II, there were those arguing for an invasion of northern France and those arguing for an invasion of southern France. It's you don't, you know, hold up and not respond to Pearl Harbor because you don't have a complete strategy that leads to the total destruction of your enemies.
Pearl Harbor. Here was the president last night describing ISIS as unique in its brutality.
They execute captured prisoners. They kill children. They enslave, rape, and force women into marriage. They threaten a religious minority with genocide. And in acts of barbarism, they took the lives of two American journalists, Jim Foley and Stephen Sotloff.
Congressman Sherman, stand by. Mark Mazzetti, of course, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, has called ISIS an imminent threat to every interest we have. And you hear the president describing barbarity there. But you quote in your piece in the New York Times this morning Daniel Benjamin, who was the State Department's top counterterrorism advisor in President Obama's first term, as saying that the public discussion around the ISIS threat has been a farce, saying, quoting here, members of the cabinet and top military officers all over the place describing the threat in lurid terms that are not justified. Is this president being kind of getting a bum's rush into this initiative, Mark?
Well, I think that the president was measured last night in describing the threat. As you quoted him, he said that, you know, right now ISIS does not pose an imminent threat to the United States. Now, that's different, though, than a lot of his administration officials have said, a lot of members of Congress, TV pundits that have described this threat as, you know, worse than pre-9/11, you know, with al-Qaeda. We are in greater danger now than we were before the 9/11 attacks. And that's not an assessment that the American intelligence agencies have. And it's reflected in polls. You know, right in this recent poll by the Wall Street Journal and NBC News says half of America thinks that the United States is at greater risk of a major terrorist attack now than it was before 9/11. And the experts I talk to say that's just not the case. And so I think when you talk about the threat, you have to be honest about what the threat is now and what the threat could be. And I think President Obama's right. ISIS seems to pose a definite threat to the region, but there's no actual intelligence now that they're plotting, have active plots against the United States. So I think when we're talking about going to war, it's very important to be very clear about what the intelligence seems to indicate.
Congressman Sherman, you just raised Pearl Harbor. Are we into that scale of threat here? Or are we? I mean, we want to be extremely sober-minded about this. We want to take care of business. The country surely wants to, but you know, we've seen long, bloody, fruitless engagements that later described as epic errors, and we don't want to do that again.
I mentioned Pearl Harbor just as a discussion of how plans change as war develops, not that this is Pearl Harbor. One thing I need to point out is that those who are fighting ISIS on the ground now, ISIS's enemies, are almost as evil and almost as dangerous as ISIS itself. They are now engaged in fighting al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda, the Assad regime, he's killed tens and tens of thousands, and the Iran Hezbollah Shiite militia Axis, which is not only developing a nuclear weapon, but also is responsible for hundreds of deaths last decade in Iraq of American soldiers, and hundreds of deaths in the 80s in Lebanon of American soldiers. So while people talk about how ISIS might be able to kill Americans, the Iranian Quds Force and the Hezbollah have killed people in terrorist actions outside their region, in South America, in Europe, in Asia, and almost carried out an assassination here in Washington, D.C. So ISIS's enemies are almost as evil and have a proven history of being perhaps even more dangerous outside the region than ISIS itself.
Trying to be smart here, but what does that mean? I want to bring our listeners in, if we may. Brad Sherman, Congressman from California, please stand by. Mark Mazzitti. Will is calling from Madison, Alabama. Thanks for calling, Will. You're on the air.
Yeah, I had spoke about this before when we last talked about this situation. And ever since we invaded Iraq, we totally destabilized that entire region of the Middle East. We had no business going over in there in the first place. Now, in order to contain this problem, you're going to have to use the tactic General Sherman used in during the Civil War, in which when he marched his soldiers into Atlanta and burned it down, you will have to declare a total war in order to contain this problem. And not only that, you may have to end up putting American forces in that region anyhow in order to make sure the area is secure for years to come.
Will, let us pick it up right there if we may. Congressman Sherman, what we've seen so far of American airstrikes is, you know, big multi-million dollar American fighter jets flying way out over the desert to take out a pickup truck. And I'm sure that was important for people facing ISIS on the ground. But our caller says we're going to have to be much heavier than that to take out the Islamic State. How would this actually work, this air-ground combo? Describe it. How would it actually end up pushing this pretty, so far, fierce player off the table?
First of all, we have many problems around the world. Even if we were willing to incur hundreds and thousands of casualties to deal with ISIS, what about all the other, you know, from Putin to Al-Qaeda Central, to Nigeria, to Libya.
No, I get it, but we've planted the flag here, the president has, saying we're going to go in and do this.
We cannot and we will not put hundreds of thousands of troops on the ground in Iraq and Syria. That means we cannot immediately destroy ISIS on the ground. We can rely to some degree on Kurdish, Iraqi, and a few reasonable elements inside Syria. We will benefit from the attacks on ISIS from al-Nusra and Assad, who, as I pointed out, are almost as evil as ISIS itself. That's why this constant refrain, where's the president's plan that guarantees total, immediate, and costless success, is a political tripe.
Mark, I don't know if you, I mean, total, complete, and immediate success, I think Americans were disabused of the possibility that everyone would like it, but we've seen these things are long. But on the other hand, they don't want endless, fruitless, and failed.
Right, and I think the president is trying to pave that middle ground. He knows that the American people don't want another Iraq war. They don't want another Afghanistan war. They don't want to see body bags coming home. And they, I think, both President Bush and President Obama have tried to sort of point out that there's another way to do this. And you can do things like drone strikes. You can do things like commando missions, special operations missions, that type of thing. And usually done in secret and covert ways and never discussed publicly. And you can kill America's enemies that way. And that seems to be a plan that can have success without any cost. But again, no war is without cost and no war is without consequences. But I think President Obama in his speech last night is trying to say, we're going to be tough. We're going to deal with this enemy, but don't worry, it's not going to look like it did before.
Said at the top of the speech, America is safer as a result of armed interventions and action in recent years, but we've got to do more here. John McCain wasn't buying it, the Yemen-Somalia model.
Now the president is saying basically that we are going to take certain actions, which I would favor. But to say that America is safer and that the situation is very much like Yemen and Somalia shows me that the president really doesn't have a grasp for how serious the threat of ISIS is.
Republican John McCain last night after President Obama's speech. Let me go to Catherine in Sandwich, Massachusetts. Catherine, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I totally understand the need for a military response. I get that. But there was a woman on Charlie Rose the other night who talked about something that was really vital in this whole, you know, thing, which was to get at the ideology of these people. My question to your guests and to you is, what can be done about that? Is it education? Is it, you know, what is causing this extreme ideology to take hold? And quite honestly, I really am afraid that it's just never going to end.
Catherine, I appreciate your call. Congressman Sherman, can you pick that up, the question about what's driving this, and is this an effective way to counter that? If it's not, I mean, could we even fan the flames of this ideology with this approach?
Well, one of the things that drives it is success. Al-Qaeda benefited from 9/11, and we should reflect that today is the anniversary of that date.
Yes.
And ISIS is getting money and followers through its battlefield success, and weapons and cash through its battlefield success by seizing the bank at Mosul, by seizing so many weapons from the Iraqi army. So success is one of the things that drives it. Battlefield success. The other is ideology, and we have to do far more in fighting the ideology, which takes Islam and twists it. And I have been pressing the State Department for a long time to increase broadcasting in a variety of languages spoken by Muslims, and to have Muslim scholars as U.S. government employees who can argue hadith to hadith, Quranic verse to Quranic verse, and show that this approach does not reflect the faith.
But Mark, ultimately, if that message gets out there, it's going to be most effective from people on the ground. Do you think this strategy will tamp down this ideology or fire it up? There have been many saying this is what ISIS wants. The provocation is intended to bring in the U.S. so people unite against it.
Sure, a strategy of military force is going to some degree play into the hands of ISIS, to the narrative of ISIS that, you know, the United States is coming in once again to kill Muslims, and so you should join ISIS and fight the United States. A group that did not, you know, these groups tend to talk about the near enemy and the far enemy being the United States and the West, the near enemy being apostates in the region, right? And the problem that you engender by having a military campaign can be that you become the near enemy. You become the enemy that they now want to fight because you're attacking them. On the point of ideology, I think everyone agrees that it is a good idea to try to counter it. But we're 13 years since 9/11, and we've shown so far that the United States as a country and as a government is not particularly great at doing this. But that doesn't mean you should stop trying.
We're talking about President Obama's battle plan for taking on ISIS, the Islamic State. Congressman Brad Sherman, senior Democratic member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, thank you so much for joining us today, Congressman Sherman. Thank you very much.
Good to be with you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama's battle plan for taking on ISIS, the Islamic State, what it counts on, where it might lead. Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for The New York Times, is with us. We just heard from Democratic Congressman Brad Sherman. We had arranged for Congressman Doug Collins of Georgia to be with us. Republicans, however, are caucusing on this very issue right now, and I don't know if we'll get him or not. Last night on Fox News, plenty of Republicans talking. Here was Senator Ted Cruz, Republican Texas, very critical of the president's speech.
I thought the remarks tonight continued the president's approach to this crisis, which is that they were fundamentally unserious. If you look at the first portion of the president's remarks tonight, they were devoted to a defense of the failed Obama-Clinton foreign policy, of the policy that had has featured the United States leading from behind, as he put it, and has led to most of the world being on fire.
Mark Mazzetti reporting on critics saying the president's got the wrong way here, taking us in too heavy. Ted Cruz right there saying too light, not serious, world's on fire. Mark Mazzetti, stand by in New York. We do have Congressman Doug Collins, Republican of Georgia, with us right now, a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, also on the Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on the Middle East and North Africa. Congressman Collins, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
What did you think of the president's strategy battle plan as outlined last night?
Well, I think that's interesting you should say strategy, battle plan, whatever. I think you basically, we'll call it at best a strategy. It was four generalizations put together on currently things that are already happening. I would like to have seen some more detail from the president on some other issues. I just came out of a briefing, in fact, that we're dealing with this morning, and we're going into another briefing here in just a little bit. So I think it's very concerning that some of the choices of words that are used. I will say this. I am glad to see that at least the administration is acknowledging that Islamic State is a threat. It is more of a threat to the region. I'm glad to see that we're actually getting support from the Arab community and the Middle Eastern community. I think those were positive steps forward. I think from here on out, though, I think that it's a determination on really what kind of action we're dealing with here, whether the administration is treating this as a police action or are they treating it actually as a military war exercise.
Which would you prefer, Congressman?
Well, I think, I've been to Iraq, and these are the same fighters that are there. They just came out of Syria. They have no intention of being treated. You know, the Islamic State is being treated as the victims or the perpetrators of a law enforcement action. They understand war. They understand that they are wanting to take over and establish the caliphate. I think what we've got to do is put it on a war footing, and the American people need to understand that. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean that we go back in as we did, right after 9/11 or in 2003 or even back to the first Gulf War? Probably not. The question is, though, is I think it's not being long-term thinking to think that maybe a first step in helping train a free Syrian army or doing those kind of actions will be sufficient to stop a very well-trained and very frankly well-supplied force.
If the president says he does not need authority from Congress to move on the outline of his plans last night, if he did put that plan to Congress, would you vote yes or no, sir?
Well, at first, he's got to put a plan together. I mean, again, he's not put a plan truly together. He gave the generalizations of what he has. Here's my understanding, and that's all very concerning from the president last night. For one point to say, I have the authority, but I would like to get Congress's buy-in, it's sort of a contradictory in terms. I mean, if you can do it, then why are you asking unless you want to cover for your own policy?
What about the $500 million that he would like Congress to sign off on to train up moderate resistance to Assad in Syria?
Well, I think those are all valid, you know, questions and concerns. I think it's for a lot of us, it was very interesting, in the timing of this has been going on for months and now, and that all of a sudden we come back in, we have a continuing resolution that needs to be passed before the end of September, and he wants it dropped into the middle of a continuing resolution. Well, look, there's many of us who understand the realities of what we're dealing with here, and there's also those of us who have seen it face first and knowing that the votes that we take here affect troops and lives in bases that are overseas and at home right now. I think we can understand the spending of certain funds and monies to combat a force that wants to kill us, especially as we're talking on a September 11th, when we're reminded of what it's, this world is not a kind place.
Congressman Collins, forgive me. You said you were happy for support from the Arab community. How serious, how real is that? What country or group do you think will put boots on the ground to support this American air campaign?
Well, again, it's a great. I mean, these are good questions that they should have been, asked the administration. They've not talked about this. We do know that there's been some support from Saudi Arabia and from other places where we could train. And the question is really going to come, and that is the issue: is how much there needs to be some very tightly defined roles in saying if we have the support supposedly of this coalition that is building. We're going to hear early next week from Secretary Kerry on how. His negotiations are coming. I'll be in the Foreign Affairs Committee for that. So it's just going to be a matter now of, frankly, just to ask for money and say, trust me, is not a good policy. I'm a trust but verify. And right now, frankly, this president on many areas of foreign policy has lost that trust factor.
Representative Doug Collins of Georgia's 9th District joining us from Washington. Thank you very much, Congressman.
Thanks, Tom. Take care.
Let's go to John in Ann Arbor, Michigan. John, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I have two brief comment questions which I want to pose.
Mm-hmm.
First, I have observed the conduct of foreign policy by every administration beginning with Truman's and don't recall one as dysfunctional or incompetent as this one. Surely a Carl Levin understands this, but no prominent Democrat has spoken out candidly on this. Why? Second, given that the president lacks credibility in the Middle East, shouldn't Congress, which has the prerogative of declaring war, do so to demonstrate that the U.S. is committed to a workable response to the very real ISIS threat we face?
John, let me ask you about your first point. You say this administration is not handling foreign policy well. I want to understand your critique. It's too light in going in, or too heavy, or something else?
I think it's too little, too late. I sent a unpublished letter to the Financial Times on August the 1st, 2011, saying that the situation had gone from deplorable to unacceptable in Syria and suggesting strong support for allies.
Too little, too late. John, we've got it. Mark, here's a caller in Michigan who wants Democrats to be speaking up because the president's coming in too little, too late. What about his own party's support?
Well, I think that you know the Democratic Party is obviously conflicted about what it wants to do. There's members who think that the president is being passive, is not being aggressive enough in dealing with, for instance, the problems in Syria. There's obviously others who think that he's now getting rushed into war. I think that members of Congress have a point if they're criticizing the president for pushing them on this $500 million that president talked about in the West Point speech in May, but Congress hasn't acted on. I mean, this is $500 million to train Syrian rebels, that a plan that the president himself has disparaged to some degree. He does not seem to put a lot of stock in it. And so there haven't been many details put to Congress in order for Congress to vote on and to make sure that this happens. So I think that shows that there's some ambivalence on the White House part.
And as you said, these are forces he was disparaging himself not so long ago, well within memory.
Right. Exactly. And I wanted to just sort of clarify this issue of authority, because both members of Congress brought it up during this hour. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for listeners, the question of does the president have authority and what authority he's exerting here. Basically, what the president said last night was, you, Congress, gave presidents the authority after 9/11, a week after 9/11, they passed the authorization for use of military force, which was this broad authorization to go find and capture or kill those people responsible for 9/11 or the affiliates. Now, obviously, we're 13 years after that, and a lot of the people involved in the 9/11 attacks are either captured or dead. But the president is still saying that that authority still applies today, that to go after ISIS, even though ISIS, it should be pointed out, broke off from al-Qaeda, is no longer an al-Qaeda affiliate. So technically, you would say, well, the AUMF of 2001 couldn't possibly apply here, but that's in part the authority that they're exerting. And so – you know, it just shows that the threat is amorphous enough, and the legal theory is still unsettled, that the president can make this case based on a 13-year-old authorization that was really passed in a very different time under very different circumstances.
We've got links here, though they may not be supportive ones. Al-Baghdadi, the head of the ISIS, who was in al-Qaeda in Iraq and who was in an American-run prison in Iraq during that war, now heading this one up. I don't know. Rand Paul saying, look, authorizations go stale. Come again. Chris in Westboro, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Chris.
Hi. This sounds like Groundhog's Day all over again, where you have the broad coalition that will help out, for a short time. They'll funnel out. We'll get some mercenaries in there to help us and assist us, who will defect to the other side. We have two terrorist fronts that we're fighting. And it's just, I'm not saying pull out. I am saying pull out. And I would say for the journalists that are over there also, pull out. You don't need to be there. And as far as having a complement of Syrian fighters there, do you really think we're going to, our best intel comes from boots on the ground. It's not going to come from Syrian fighters. We're not going to be dropping laser guided bombs from half-renegade group of Syrian fighters. We're not going to be taking the intel from them. We need our special forces on the ground over there to establish some connection so we can track these people.
Yeah, I kind of hear you saying you assume that they will eventually go there.
They will absolutely have boots on the ground. I'm sure we have boots on the ground there now, just as we ended up grabbing Osama bin Laden through Pakistan with our special forces without their permission. I can assure you and everybody else here, we already have our assets in place that are tracking these people.
A lot of skepticism right there, Chris. We hear it loud and clear. The president's saying otherwise, but we hear the skepticism. And there's a lot of history on which Americans will look at this and judge and consider. Let's go to Evansville, Indiana. Mike is calling. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
My point is this. When we go into the Middle East, into these Arab countries, and we support or we fight against, you know, either a Sunni or Shiite force, you know, it's taken as an offense. But when, you know, if we were to have the partnership of other Arab countries, of Sunni and Shiite leaders, I feel like we could potentially, you know, make a change. But without that, I don't see how we can do that in Iraq and Syria. Is there anything that we can do to put pressure on the other Arab leaders to come together and to work together to, you know, to find a solution in Syria and Iraq that would, you know, meet both sides?
It's a great question. It may be the fundamental question here. I appreciate it, Mike, from Evansville. Mark Mazzetti, how about it? I mean, Iran is already active in Iraq. We know that. But that's been polarizing. It has hardly pulled the country together so far, them backing Shiites and Shiites really getting the Sunni wound up. Saudi Arabia, we've had individual Saudis actually supporting the Islamic State. Is it clear that we can rally the big, powerful neighbors of Iraq and Syria to get involved enough in a granular enough way to make a difference here, Mark?
Well, and to some degree, it's starting to happen. I mean, you have this, as we wrote today, you've got this sort of comic book enemy in ISIS that has everyone, this villain that everyone is lining up against. The only force that in the Middle East that can get the Israelis and the Iranians and the Sunnis and the Shiites and Pope Francis all on the same side, that this group needs to be stopped. But of course, what does that mean? So these groups are worried about ISIS, but are they all going to really work together to fight? And as you pointed out, it's one thing for the government of Saudi Arabia to be opposed to ISIS and to offer up its territory to do some training of Syrian rebels. It's another to try to stop individuals in Saudi Arabia from funding ISIS. That's a totally different story. So I think that it is quite striking to have so many different partners with so many very, very different interests involved in the fight against ISIS, but it's unclear what this coalition is really going to lead to.
The president asserts that he has it, but yeah, what does it really mean? Hassan in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hassan, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. I have a comment regarding one of the points that was raised before the break. One of your guest speakers spoke about, you know, the possibility of having Muslim scholars working with the American government to kind of, you know, fight the ideologies that the ISIS has.
Yes.
And I think I'm a Muslim scholar myself, an imam who works and resides in the United States.
Okay.
I have been here for 2 years, and I moved from the Middle East. And I can tell you that having more troops and having a military intervention might make the situation even worse, because you might solve the problem temporarily, but then you will have the ideology that will stay there and will, you know, cause more and even worse violence in the future. I think that military intervention is a bad idea. We have seen it before. I have been a child when I was a teenager studying Islam in Egypt when the United States, you know, troops walked into Baghdad. We have seen people in Iraq very happy and very cheerful, but then the situation started to get worse later.
Hassan, so, you're a Muslim scholar. Let me ask you. The president, first of all, says ISIS is not Muslim because it kills the innocent. And the assumption is also here that Muslims will not support its drive for a new caliphate. Do you agree with those two things?
Absolutely. I do not support, first of all, ISIS does not represent Islam, does not represent the mainstream of Islam. You know, their practices are a total misunderstanding, a total destruction of the, you know, the Islamic faith. I'm an imam in my congregation. all the people in my congregation, all of them, regardless of their background, where they come from, what kind of Islam they are practicing, they are totally against ISIS. But at the same time, a military intervention would not really help the situation at all. If anything, it will make it worse. You have people who are unemployed. You have people who are frustrated, who are coming from all over the world to join this barbaric and terrorist group.
Hassan, I appreciate your perspective. An imam out of Cedar Rapids there right now. Mark Marzetti, the backlash issue is always there. It's been the issue from the beginning. Would American intervention create more pushback than it solves?
That's the biggest question since 9/11, right? Are you creating as many terrorists as more terrorists than you're actually killing? For me, what was so striking about the speech last night was the contrast to a year and a half ago when President Obama spoke at NDU and talked about this war must end and it can end at some point. What he said last night was something that is far different and a war that will go on for some time.
Boy. Talk about a worrying picture. Maybe he's got the right formula, but we have learned these things can go long and dear and not necessarily at all effective. Much more to be said on this front. Mark Mazzetti, you're terrific as always, and we thank you for your time and insights today. National security correspondent for the New York Times joining us from Washington. Mark, good luck with your reporting. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. You can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.